Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. I always start by looking at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the Huffington Post by Adam Clark Estes, Move Your Money, Tell Us About Your Local Bank. As national banks soak up bailout dollars, cut lending, and exploit overdraft fees, a number of Americans have decided to move their money to local banks. While Wells Fargo and Citigroup have made headlines recently for repaying the massive debts they owe to the American taxpayer, people are still frustrated about subsidizing the gambling habits of mega banks. A recent post, Move Your Money, generated a lot of comments from readers who want to ditch their accounts with the too big to fail crew. The following mega banks took the most bailout money from the government: Bank of America, $45 billion, Citigroup, $45 billion, Wells Fargo, $25 billion, and JP Morgan Chase, $25 billion. According to Treasury's most recent report on the bailout, our massive subsidy of the behemoth banks didn't pay off especially well. Large financial institutions made record profits last year. Neighborhood banks, on the other hand, were forced to sharply increase their rates of consumer loans to fill demand. For these reasons, and many, many more, we're seriously thinking about localnomics. I highly recommend that you go to the URL moveyourmoney, that's all one word, .info. Again, moveyourmoney.info, to get a deep understanding of why this would be a good move from the mega banks to your local banks, how to do it, and also what to look out for. For example, there's a 7-step checklist for moving your checking account. What is stated is that big banks have the advantage of inertia. Moving your checking and savings accounts is not as simple as switching grocery stores. You'll have to maintain both your new account and old accounts for a few weeks until everything switches over. That can be a little tricky, especially if you're living paycheck to paycheck. After you've found your new financial institution, follow this simple sequence compiled by Stacy Mitchell of the New Rules Project's Community Banking Initiative, and keep an eye on things. It should go smoothly, and in a few weeks, you'll be in a brand new banking relationship. So number one is open your new account. In most cases, you should be able to open a checking account with an initial deposit of between $25 and $100. At a credit union, you'll also become a member and co-owner at the same time. Number two, order your new debit ATM card and checks. These typically arrive within 1 to 2 weeks. 3. If you use direct deposit, ask your employer to reroute your paycheck to your new account. When you open your new account, ask the bank or credit union for a direct deposit authorization form that includes your new account information. Give this form to your employer and anyone else who makes direct deposits to your account. It may take one or more pay cycles for the change to be made, so keep your old checking account open and watch for the switch. Number four, contact companies that direct debit your account. Using your last bank statement make a list of any businesses that you've authorized to directly debit your account. Ask your new bank or credit union for an automatic payment authorization form that includes your new account information. Send this to the businesses on your list. Number 5, set up online bill paying for your new account. If you like to pay bills online, which I highly recommend, set up bill payment information for your new account. Meanwhile, stop any automatic recurring payments you have established through your old account. Number 6, close your old account. Once you have started receiving direct deposits into your new account and are sure that there are no outstanding checks or automatic debits that need to clear, close your old account. Warning, do not just withdraw the last dollar and assume the account will fade away on its own. Your old big bank may start charging you fees for having an empty or inactive checking account. Instead, follow the bank's procedure for closing out the account. And number 7, enjoy your new local banking relationship. So that's the checklist for 7 easy steps to move your checking account. And an article by Vincent Fernando, America increasingly looks like a developing nation as 30% of Americans rapidly approach poverty or are already there. A shocking report from Brookings exposes just how massive America's poverty problem is. While substantial reductions in poverty were made during the 1990s, America's poor have been rocked by the dual economic downturns since the year 2000. The result is that poverty grew at twice the rate of U.S. population growth from 2000 to 2008 and now encompasses 39.1 million Americans. If one were to expand the definition of poverty to mean merely poor, yet still very poor, then an eye-popping 30% of the nation lives no higher than twice the poverty baseline. From Brookings, in 2008, 91.6 million people, more than 30% of the nation's population, fell below 200% of the federal poverty level. More individuals lived in families with incomes between 100 and 200% of the poverty line, that's 52.5 million people, than below the poverty line, 39.1 million people in 2008. Between 2000 and 2008, large suburbs saw the fastest growing low-income populations across community types and the greatest uptick in the share of the population living under the 200% of poverty level. Here's where it gets even more ridiculous. If you break down the data to individual areas, then there's at least 10 U.S. cities with poverty rates of around 30%. Moreover, Brookings' latest research highlights how poverty has been getting worse, especially fast in the suburbs. Thus, the U.S. is faced with the challenges of suburban poverty like never before. In particular, California and Florida have been hit especially hard. Finally, this bad news has likely become far worse already. This research doesn't include 2009, since full data hasn't come out yet. When it does, expect a huge uptick in poverty rates, given since that's when the real brunt of the recent crisis hit Main Street. Unfortunately, our regression analysis suggests that these metro areas are not likely to see such decreases in 2009, a year in which no metro area proved exempt from increased unemployment rates. Although the census will not officially release poverty rates for 2009 until fall of next year, job losses alone foretell a substantially larger increase in the metropolitan poverty rate than the 0.3% reported from 2007 to 2008, when unemployment increases were just beginning to accelerate. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's continue on with our look at the two-income trap, why middle-class Parents Are Going Broke, which is a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiaki. And I commence with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiaki, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And you could also visit all of my shows at www.kruufm.com. Go into Archives under Life in Debt, and you can get a complete replay of all the shows that I have produced to help you deal with your debt, good, bad, and ugly. Last week, I was talking about the myth of the immoral debtor in terms of bankruptcy and how, in fact, that turns out to be a falsity that people are filing bankruptcy when we look at all of the statistics and anecdotes. The bottom line is that they don't file as an easy way out. People can be exposed to losing some assets when they file bankruptcy, depending on the exemption law and the state that they're in. Under the 2005 Act, some people can be forced from a liquidation Chapter 7 into a repayment plan under Chapter 13, depending on the household size and how much money the household is bringing in, whether it's below the state median income or above it. So that's a pressure. There's a lot of psychological factors involved. First of all, bankruptcy is a public filing. There are court records, and there is access to those court records. And most people do not know until they go see a bankruptcy attorney that, except for creditors involved in the case, not many more people will find out about the bankruptcy, but there is a fear and a pressure in that concern. Their credit reports are affected, as it will be listed on their credit report that they filed bankruptcy for 10 years. And when they go to get a new loan or sometimes even a new apartment or job, credit reports are run and the issue comes up. Again, this is a fear-inducing circumstance. Another point is they actually have to go to court, usually a hearing room, not a courtroom, and sit with other people who have also filed bankruptcy plus lawyers in front of a trustee and discuss their case under oath, which frankly is a fearful thing for many people. But as Professor Warren says, if a family is willing to go through all that, some of its debts are erased and they get a fresh start in spite of the challenges, particularly psychological, that they have to confront. But the important question is, are the families using the bankruptcy court more liberally than they used to? Professor Warren looked at the data and says that it doesn't support that argument. And one way she analyzes this was that if a growing number of people were looking for the easy way out, that is, bankruptcy is part of this myth, then we would expect to find that families in bankruptcy today are in a relatively better shape than those who filed a generation ago. The example Elizabeth uses is we might find that they have smaller debt loads relative to their incomes, with the clear implication that at least some of these folks could pay off the debts if they tried a little harder. The data shows, however, that just the opposite has happened. Today's bankrupt families are deeper in debt than their counterparts 30 years earlier, and their overall financial picture, assets and debts, is worse. In 1981, the median family filing for bankruptcy owed 80% of total annual income in credit card and other non-mortgage debt. By 2001, that figure nearly doubled to 150% of annual income. And as the numbers are analyzed today, it's even worse. The credit industry, which has the most to gain from prying a few dollars out of bankrupt families, estimates that only 10% of families who file for bankruptcy could actually afford to repay even a portion of their discharge debts. And as a footnote, independent academics put the number closer to 1-2%. But using the credit card company's numbers, that would leave a remaining 90% of people are tapped out, too broke for even their creditors to bother with. Professor Warren points out that there are other signs that families are not rushing headlong into bankruptcy. The average person who filed for bankruptcy reports spending more than a year struggling with debts before filing. Before they finally gave up and filed, 50% of the families had their utilities or telephone shut off for non-payment, and nearly 60% did without needed medical care in order to save money. According to her data, 1 in 5 of these college-educated home-owning families in bankruptcy said they had done without food at some point before filing because they simply couldn't afford it. By the time they sought refuge in the bankruptcy courts, the average family owed more than an entire year's income in non-mortgage debt. Also, besides bankruptcy statistics, the number of home foreclosures has skyrocketed in the past 25 years, and car repossession have become fairly standard activities throughout the country. So obviously, this is not a game. A family who no longer has a roof over its head is not having much fun. And filing bankruptcy is one very valid option to deal with their financial distress. And the second thing we looked at was fraud and abuse under the myth of the immoral debtor. And that basically is that people are willing to lie, cheat, and file for bankruptcy under false pretenses. First thing is that who knows for certain how much fraud there is, and the courts do go to great lengths to try to prevent it. A person who wanted to commit fraud on a bankruptcy petition usually would try to hide his assets from his creditors. What happens is these offshore accounts, bogus trusts, or through transfers to a separate corporation or another person. Well, as a bankruptcy attorney, we know that every single personal bankruptcy filing is accompanied by detailed financial disclosures filed under penalty of perjury, reviewed by court-appointed trustees, and made public for any creditor or other interested party to scrutinize. Plus, the individual filing has to go to court, swear to tell the truth, submit to a possible cross-examination both by the trustee and any creditor who would appear. And it is true that if anything does appear suspicious, the debtor will be ordered back into court by a judge and examined further under oath. Anyone who files a fraudulent bankruptcy petition or misrepresents his circumstances violates federal law and risks prosecution by the Department of Justice. It's very serious. A guilty verdict would result in jail time, probably. It's also true that any creditor who can show that a debtor lied on a credit application or otherwise committed fraud can have that debt exempted from discharge in bankruptcy, and that creditor is also entitled to file criminal charges. So looking at all this, even if they had evil in their hearts, it would be extremely difficult for the average family in bankruptcy to commit serious fraud. The majority of people who file just aren't financially sophisticated. They don't have Swiss bank accounts, dummy corporations, or offshore accounts. They're ordinary middle-class families whose total assets usually consist of a home, a car, and maybe a checking account. Professor Warren's study of 2,000 bankrupt families, only one owned a second home, which was a small rental house that produced income and it was not a vacation place, and no one had an offshore account or a self-settled trust. So the thought of fraud and abuse is quite unsubstantiated. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I have been talking about the myth of the immoral debtor, and the sub-thought was fraud and abuse, and went over some reasons why this is not substantiated. The conclusion that Professor Warren made was that the number of families committing fraud and filing bankruptcy may have inched up over the years, although there really is no evidence to support that claim. But when she goes through the numbers, she says that if fraud alone accounted for the increase in the number of bankruptcies over the past generation, then 8 out of every 10 families filing for bankruptcy today would have to be committing fraud. Now that is a pretty absurd suggestion, because in the last decade, roughly 10 million families independently decided that they would commit a felony that could land them in jail and that no one else heard about it. This is not very real. The professor concludes that the myth of the immoral debtor might make for good headlines, but like the overconsumption myth, it won't hold up to hard analysis. Of course, we can say, yeah, there are some people who are cheating, just like there are some people who are overconsuming. Being in financial trouble confers no special state of grace that eliminates all the sharp operators and crafty manipulators who are traveling among us. But the stark numbers, bankruptcy filings that have quintupled, mortgage foreclosures that have tripled, car repossessions that have at least doubled, cannot be explained away so easily. So we look at what went wrong. If the bankruptcy system isn't packed with frauds and cheats, then why are so many families in trouble? With about 1.5 million families declaring bankruptcy each year, one might expect innumerable explanations for all that financial mayhem. During Professor Warren's study in her interviews, there were a wide variety of reasons for the financial problems. Some were victims of crime, some made bad investments, some had problems with alcohol or gambling, some lost their homes in a flood or an earthquake. A few had actually done what the overconsumption camp had accused them of. They bought too many goodies on their credit cards. Professor Warren's outstanding story, she said, was fellow who filed for bankruptcy after he was shot while trying to foil a robbery at a nearby hardware store, and the resulting hospital bills and time off from work destroyed him financially. And those kinds of stories go on and on when we talk to our clients. These stories are memorable for odd details, but the statistics really reveal a much simpler picture. The overwhelming majority of financial failures are surprising not for their uniqueness, but for their sameness. So here it goes. Nearly 9 out of 10 families with children cite just 3 reasons for their bankruptcies: job loss, family breakup, and medical problems. All the other reasons combined, such as acts of God, called up for military service, personal wastefulness, and so on, account for just 13% of families in bankruptcy. 87% for job loss, medical problems, divorce, or separation, and the remaining 13% for everything else. Now that's why people are filing bankruptcy. In essence, there's nothing new or even exotic about the problems faced by American families today. Jobs have come and gone, couples have broken up, there's illnesses, injuries, and these are facts of life since the beginning of mankind. But again, we're talking about the two-income trap, and the two-income trap has compounded the ordinary risks of daily life. With mom in the workplace and the family safety net forfeited, as I've discussed in prior shows, a short-term job loss or medium-sized illness now poses a much greater menace to a family that has no reserves. It takes less to sink these families. As a result, more of them go under and file bankruptcy. And when we look at this carefully, the two-income family didn't just lose its safety net by placing both adults into the labor force. These families actually increased the chances that they would need that safety net. In fact, they doubled the risk. With two adults in the workforce, the dual-income family has double the odds that someone could get laid off, downsized, or otherwise left without a paycheck. Mom or dad could suddenly lose a job now. If we look back in time to the typical 1970s single-income family, the husband faced a 2.5% chance of losing his job in any given year. Then if we jump to the present-day two-earner couple, and if they worked back in the 70s, they would have had a 4.9% chance of a major drop in income, which is almost double the chances of a single-income family. As a footnote, it's not exactly 5%, 2.5 plus 2.5, because in some of the families, both the husband and wife will be laid off. So the total number of families who experience a layoff is slightly less than 5%. But no matter how the odds are calculated, the principle is straightforward. Two workers, two chances to lose a job. As Professor Warren points out, this situation would be tough enough for the two-income family if the working world had stayed the same over the past generation. But you just have to watch television or listen to the nightly news, read the newspapers, go on the internet. The world is not the same. The economy is not the same today. Right now, today, the chances that a worker will be laid off, downsized, or restructured out of a paycheck has increased substantially to a level that we have probably never seen in America, at least since the Great Depression. Even before the most recent recession, the numbers that Professor Warren came up with were that a worker would suffer an involuntary job loss was 28% higher since the 1970s. And again, this is before this current recession and the huge number of jobs that are being lost in the last 2 years. So if we look at today's dual income family, the numbers actually are doubly grim because each spouse faces a higher likelihood of a job layoff. And just before the current recession, Professor Warren estimated that in a single year, roughly 6.3% of dual income families, which is one out of every 16, will receive a pink slip. That means that a family at that time, with both husband and wife in the workforce, is approximately 2.5 times more likely to face a job loss than a single income family of a generation ago. And we don't even have the analysis of the likelihood since the recession, but we know without even doing it that the chance of loss for a two income family is much higher today. In short, the two-income family is definitely in a bigger trap today than it was before the recession and certainly than it would have been a generation ago. And we'll continue looking at other reasons next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.